Case number 21-3252, USA v. Elmer Jones. All arguments not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Paul Crozier for the appellant.
May it please the court, I'm Paul Crozier representing appellant Elmer Jones. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for appeal. We have five issues in this case, Your Honors. I'd like to primarily focus on assignments of error 3 and 4. Most important assignment of error 3, because I think it largely drove everything that happened in this case. Mr. Jones had given a proffer, which comes up in assignment of error 4. The case probably would have pled out, but for the involvement of a disbarred attorney who was advising Mr. Jones specifically in great detail about the speedy trial issue, which the trial court rejected. I have argued it here because it is not frivolous, but I don't have a whole lot of belief that the court will agree with me on the speedy trial violation. But the focus here really is this disbarred attorney. The trial court discouraged the defendant from continuing to communicate with him, but he's continued to communicate with him.
What was the trial judge supposed to do? He seemed fairly adamant. He called the guy out on the phone. What else was he going to do? I mean, a formal order of some sort or what?
I think he had to, and Mr. Jones is incarcerated. I think the judge could easily have caused a cessation of communications there. If the person was a family member or a friend and not a disbarred attorney, I think it would have been different. But everything that happened in this case ultimately happened because of the advice that this former attorney was giving to Mr. Jones.
How do we know that? That's a sweeping statement. Well, everything happened is the blame of this disbarred attorney. To answer the issue posed by you, the district judge would have had to have a hearing or something to determine what advice was being provided and whether it was being done in Mr. Pappas's capacity as an attorney or informally as a friend. And the defendant wants to talk to his friend about his case, even though that he's talking to a disbarred attorney. And how was the district court responsible for ascertaining all the aspects of that relationship? He told the attorney not to advise the defendant legally. He told the defendant not to accept legal advice from the allegedly disbarred attorney. Why wasn't that sufficient?
Your Honor, probably the best example would be the Speedy Trial Act motion that Mr. Jones submitted pro se that was written by Mr. Pappas and submitted by Mr. Pappas to Mr. Jones' appointed counsel and to the U.S. attorney as a motion that Mr. Jones was making pro se, and it ended up being filed as a pro se motion by Mr. Jones to dismiss the case for a speedy trial violation. That was written by Mr. Pappas. It was discussed at some length by the trial court with him.
Well, who was representing the defendant at the time that the pro se motion was filed?
Appointed counsel, Your Honor. Originally, Mr. Pappas' son was appearing pro hac from California, but after the COVID problems arose, he said he was incapable because he lost his staff and he didn't have the money to fly out to Ohio.
And did appointed counsel advise the court that, in appointed counsel's opinion, that motion should not have been filed, or was not truly a pro se motion, or should be disregarded by the court, or anything like that?
Yeah, yes, Your Honor. In fact, appointed counsel, I think, made 3 motions to withdraw as a result of the interference by Mr. Jones's friend.
Well, we can characterize it as interference, or we could say counsel wanted to withdraw because of the breakdown in the attorney-client relationship, of which the defendant's relationship with Mr. Pappas was only a symptom of the breakdown in the attorney-client relationship. But I don't know how the district judge would be able to ascertain all that.
Fair enough, Your Honor. I think the frustration of the district court comes through in those transcripts of the phone calls that he's having with Mr. Pappas, and the fact that Mr. Jones gave a full proffer to the FBI. There's an agreement, that's the fourth assignment of error. There's an agreement as to its use. He's basically confessed to everything that's been charged. Mr. Pappas, he was apparently unaware or didn't care about that. It didn't advise him on that. And Mr. Jones disregards his appointed counsel's recommendations. The case goes to trial. They end up in this issue that came up on the fourth assignment of error, with the trial court actually prohibiting cross-examining witnesses as to the veracity of the proffer of Mr. Jones's guilt. Basically, the trial judge says any attempt to assert innocence is prohibited.
Was there, you started off saying that your client would have pleaded out except for the work of this attorney Pappas. Was there a plea bargain offered that was rejected by the defendant here?
There was discussion of a plea bargain. At one point, the U.S. attorney said that it was interfered with, that they were never able to get to that point of having an effective plea negotiation. It does not appear in the record, and from an outside perspective, I don't think that there's a record of an actual offer being made. I think Mr. Rankin may be able to speak to that as well. Sticking with the fourth assignment of error, it's the violation of a proffer agreement. The remedy is to allow the proffer to come in. Whether that would have been beneficial to Mr. Jones or not was for trial counsel to decide and for Mr. Jones to decide. That issue, we don't know what the appropriate standard of review is on the question of whether the trial court erred in prohibiting cross-examination of witnesses that would violate the proffer agreement or not. The remedy listed in the contract.
I thought he said they could be impeached. His testimony could be impeached by the proffer.
What he said was, you're prohibited. That's the problem.
I thought that was the first time. I thought it was clarified at that point. There was no prohibit, that he couldn't prohibit.
I don't think he said, I can't prohibit it, Your Honor. I think what he said was,
well, the proffer agreement states that the proffer could be used for impeachment if the defendant made arguments that were inconsistent with the proffer.
Yes, sir.
And that's the situation we have here, is it not?
It's not, because what the judge said is, so I will tell you clearly, you will not throw out any additional cross-examine, elicit any testimony from any witnesses about the methamphetamine, period.
And the judge said that, then the judge subsequently clarified to say that such arguments opened the door for impeachment. So the judge corrected himself and made the correct ruling on that point.
Well, Your Honor, he starts off by making a ruling, then he explains his reasoning. But as I read this, he says, I do not want that to happen. Does that refer to a violation of the proffer agreement, or does that refer to any assertion of actual innocence? I read that as being an explanation of his reasoning and not as a modification of his initial ruling. I thought the initial ruling was perfectly clear.
But couldn't you read that language, though I don't I do not want that to happen to mean that the district judge was trying to protect your client, and then the counsel for your client then understood that's what the district judge was saying and then decided not to pursue that line of questioning and argument?
I actually think that's very likely, Your Honor. I think that the trial court was attempting to protect Mr. Jones from the consequences of his acts, even in getting to trial, where he'd clearly confessed. He'd given a full statement, a multi-page statement to the FBI agents with counsel and with a previous contract that said he was guilty in every respect. The fact that this case is here at all goes back to the third assignment of error of the trial court just didn't protect the client from the disbarred counsel.
What's the prejudice on this, on the proffer error then? What's the prejudice to your client?
The prejudice is that the trial court basically violated the contract that he'd made with the FBI as to allowing the admission of the statement rather than a prohibition on the testimony.
But, okay, so he didn't allow the confession, he didn't allow the defendant's own confession to come in. How did that prejudice your client?
Well,
how was he harmed? How would the trial have come out differently?
That's a good question, Your Honor. I don't know that it's any different.
Well, don't you need to show some prejudice for the error? Otherwise, it's harmless, isn't
it? The long-term prejudice, I think, is unknowable. The short-term prejudice is that he was deprived of the right to cross-examine the witnesses.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, Daniel Ranke for the government. As far as Your Honor, the question as to whether there was any plea negotiations, they were limited. There was an offer to allow Mr. Jones to plead guilty to the indictment but reserve his right to appeal the speedy trial issue. At that point, Mr. Jones declined and said he wasn't interested in any type of plea offer. That was at R-141.
That was after the proffer?
Yeah, it was page ID 2026.
It seems odd. I don't know why. I mean, if you're going to proffer all of that, why are you going to go to trial? It seems odd, but...
Yeah. As far as...
I mean, I guess that's your friend on the other side. His point is, it seems odd because we have this outside interference who is giving him advice or whatever it is, and that took the case off the course that it would have been on. It does seem odd to me, so maybe that has some legs. I don't know.
Well, it's a question as to whether it took the case off the track it was on. I mean, there was a proffer, but after the judge denied the speedy trial motion.
The pro se one?
Well, the pro se one, and then he also went on the record and discussed it at length. Mr. Jones didn't then say, I'm now going to plead guilty, even though he had the opportunity to plead guilty and repeal that ruling. He wanted to go to trial. And there's a chance that even after the trial, we don't know, but there's a chance that even after the proffer, he wanted to go to trial. The proffer was with another counsel. And part of Judge Adams' instruction during trial was, and Mr. Billick admitted he wasn't the attorney during the proffer, and Judge Adams, even though he started out saying he was prohibiting it, he actually did clarify it and say, if the remedy is going to be if you go down this road, the government's going to be able to bring in these agents and they're going to be able to submit this testimony. So the court didn't prohibit Mr. Jones from claiming the methamphetamine, and it was basically the methamphetamine. It was the 16 pounds of methamphetamine. And the court didn't prohibit that. The court just explained, look, if you do this, you're going to open the door. And the court was concerned that he had already opened the door to that. But the court said, if you go down that road, the remedy is going to be the government can bring in these agents and they can testify. At that point, he still had the choice. If he wanted to bring in these, you know, to bring in the agents and cross-examine them, he could have. But the judge said, the judge basically wanted to make sure that it was an informed decision, and he didn't want that to happen unless Jones understood that that was the course that he was on. And there are a number of cases that say that is the appropriate remedy if the proffer, a proffer agreement, you know, that you could waive the proffer protected statement. As far as John Pappas, that's when Judge Adams first learned of John Pappas' involvement. It was at a hearing on, I think, end of September 2020. At that point, Damian Billick informed the judge that John Pappas had contacted him, and that John Pappas also, I think he had CC'd the AUSA as well, and that he was giving, and he believed that John Pappas was Matthew Pappas' father, and that John Pappas was giving advice to Mr. Jones. At that point, Judge Adams didn't know that John Pappas was a suspended attorney. As far as he knew at that point, Damian Billick didn't know if he was an attorney or not. The government didn't know, and he asked Mr. Jones, and Mr. Jones said actually he was Matthew Pappas' father and that he did not believe he was an attorney. So at that point, Judge Adams, I think, took the appropriate step of informing Mr. Jones or advising Mr. Jones that he shouldn't take legal advice from a non-attorney, and that he should listen to his own counsel, Damian Billick, who understood the case law and the facts of this case, and that listening to John Pappas, and at this point, again, that who he thinks isn't an attorney.
Would Judge Adams have had the power, I get, does he have the inherent authority or something to basically say you cannot have any contact with this person anymore?
I don't think so.
Regardless of whether he's giving you legal advice, not legal advice, you're just not to talk to him, or you'll be, well, I guess it would be directed at Pappas. You can't talk to this guy anymore, or you're in contempt. I don't even know if he has jurisdiction. The guy's in California, but what?
I don't see how he could do that. I mean, if there was a reference to, okay, what if he wasn't a suspended attorney? He was just a friend, family member, interested person. We can kind of assume John Pappas got involved in this because of his son represented Mr. Jones for 3 months before he asked to be removed.
But I take it the judge did have the authority to say to him, don't give him legal advice.
Yes, yes. Only once he found out, and that goes into then the next hearing on October 29th. That's the hearing that Damian Billick comes in again, and he says, Mr. Pappas is still involved in this case. And Judge Adams decides to get Mr. Pappas on the phone. So he gets Mr. Pappas on the phone. They have a fairly animated discussion about what Mr. Pappas is doing. And Mr. Pappas, at that point, represents himself as an airline pilot. Now, I don't know at that point if Judge Adams is not an airline pilot. I'm sorry, just a pilot. He never worked for an airline. But at that point, if I'm charged with a crime and my neighbor says, well, I've got all these great ideas for you, Judge Adams can't say, well, you can't talk to, your neighbor. I mean, I can talk to who I want. And I think the tenor of the conversation changed when Judge Adams found out, and during the hearing, Judge Adams
What if your neighbor says, I'm going to draft some pleadings for you, but I'm not a lawyer, can the judge say you're not allowed to do that?
I don't think so. I mean, you can't file them.
Does the judge have inherent authority to say there'll be no unauthorized practice of law in my court?
Yes. Yes. The judge does have inherent authority to do that.
So is Pappas engaged in the unauthorized practice of law when he drafts that motion?
Well, that's the judge. At that point, this is when the judge finds out that he is a suspended attorney as well. And then the tenor of the...
Right. I mean, he didn't know he was a suspended attorney until he does his... Look, apparently Judge Adams or his court must have done some extra research, and they find out this guy, and they're like, hey, this guy's a, and then he admits it, you know, essentially admits it on the phone.
Right. Actually, it was during the hearing, Judge Adams had his staff look him up, and they found out, you know, his status.
But frequently in all kinds of litigation, people who are pro se rely on shadow lawyers to help them, whether it's a neighbor or a disbarred attorney or somebody who just doesn't want to have their name on the documents. And are there cases that say that the district judge has to prohibit a party from utilizing this so-called help from non-lawyers?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I didn't find any when we were looking and researching this. The cases that we found and that the appellant cited as well were the cases dealing with that company, the National Legal Professional Associates, which was a company out of Cincinnati, actually, that was providing paralegals, ostensible paralegal services, but they were actually enjoined because they were practicing law, but there was a lot more to that those cases. They were enjoined. They were actually soliciting customers. They were charging a fee. They were large scale. Here you have just Mr. Pappas, who took an interest in this case, probably because his son was involved. And Mr. Pappas always disputed whether he was practicing law. I think the judge ruled on that, the pro se motion, in a way to try to assist Mr. Jones to understand that in the current climate at that point, that his speedy trial motion didn't have any merit. And he thought if he put it on the record and then ruled on the motion, that maybe Mr. Jones would understand that the speedy trial time had been told by the general orders of the court, the COVID orders, and also the court's ends of justice continuances involving Matthew Pappas and then Mr. Billick to allow him to prepare. I think that's why the judge ruled on the motion, he wasn't treating Mr. Pappas as an attorney. It was really trying to, again, protect Mr. Jones and allow Mr. Jones to see, look, this isn't a good idea for you.
So at that point, when the district judge ruled on the speedy trial motion, the defendant could have started up again negotiating with the U.S. Attorney's Office, right, for a plea bargain at that point?
I believe that was also maybe, the record doesn't say, but I think that's reasonable to assume that was part of Judge Adams' motivation as well, as to maybe get him to rethink a possible plea.
Because the proffer, the proffer agreement would have allowed him to challenge the speedy trial issue later on, right?
I believe so, yeah. He wasn't precluded from that. And he was actually, and again, the plea negotiations were never really went anywhere, but he was offered the opportunity to plead guilty to the indictment but preserve that issue if he believed it was an issue worth appealing. And he, at that point, said he wasn't interested. The speedy trial claim, I think, is pretty well set forth in the briefs. Again, the judge, there were five general orders that prohibited the court from actually having jury trials up until September 21st. Mr. Jones was indicted on March 4th, I believe. Those orders took effect starting March 16th, and then went through September 21st, and then Judge Adams also issued a number of ends of justice continuances where he adopted those orders and then gave time for Damian Billick to prepare. And Damian Billick had a COVID issue as well, which was also three more weeks that was excluded. Ultimately, I think approximately 25 to, and I was looking again last night, maybe 28 days elapsed that were countable days. So the speedy trial issue, I don't believe has any merit. As far as removing Matthew Pappas, Matthew Pappas actually asked to be taken off the case. He was admitted pro hoc vice at the end of February of 2020. The record shows that he did very little, if anything, between the time he was admitted until June 15th, when the court had a show cause hearing, which Mr. Pappas didn't show up. This is Matthew Pappas, didn't show up for. He did file a response in which he said that the COVID pandemic had decimated his practice. He was no longer able to represent Mr. Jones, and that he asked that his pro hoc vice status be relinquished and that counsel be appointed to represent Mr. Jones. The judge went through this with Mr. Jones. Mr. Jones was never dissatisfied with Matthew Pappas, but he realized after Judge Adams explained it that Matthew Pappas had withdrawn and there wasn't a whole lot he could do going forward as far as Matthew Pappas, so they appointed Mr. Billick. After the judge inquired if, the judge explained that either Mr. Jones could hire another attorney, represent himself, or the judge could appoint an attorney if Mr. Jones didn't have any money. Mr. Jones indicated that he didn't have any more money. The judge appointed Damian Billick, and Mr. Jones did not object. As far as his sentence, the judge relied on basically the amount and variety of drugs that Mr. Jones was apprehended with, and that he had a firearm. Mr. Jones did express remorse, but it was very general remorse, almost for he was sorry for being involved in the drug trade. The judge, that really wasn't what Judge Adams felt was actual, a true statement of remorse. Being involved in the drug trade didn't really acknowledge the individual harm he had done. The judge indicated he would like to have heard more of that type of a statement, and he implied a within guideline sentence. If there are no further questions, I would ask that the district court be affirmed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honor, the trial court here could have issued an injunction. That was the whole point in the United States versus Johnson case that I cited coming out of the Seventh Circuit. The Seventh Circuit affirmed the order prohibiting the National Legal Professional Associations from the unauthorized practice of law. I think that contrary to the judge in an early conversation with Mr. Jones, it's a transcript 65 at page 281, to Mr. Pappas, said, "I cannot stop you from communicating with him and giving him advice." But that's exactly what the court needed to do. This is a case kind of like the United States versus Hall, which this court decided in 2000. It's 200 F3rd 962, where Judge Martin wrote, "This is one of the unusual cases where the court should have stepped in to ensure an adequate legal defense for the defendant." Basically, it's Judge Adams didn't do enough. He didn't protect this defendant from the bad advice he was getting, even though the judge discussed it on that same page. He talked, said, "I can't stop you from communicating." He said, but then he says he could. He says, rather than issue some sort of order prohibiting you from doing this, this is a courtesy call. I'm going to encourage you, and clearly it didn't work. The encouragement did not stop the communications. It didn't.
So the bad advice was vis-a-vis the speedy trial.
The bad advice that we can point to in the record, Your Honor, is the speedy trial.
Okay. Because and you're making a speedy trial argument on appeal. So arguably, isn't it a contradiction for you to say that John Pappas gave bad advice on a speedy trial defense when you, in fact, are making a speedy trial defense in this appeal?
Your Honor, the speedy trial argument is not frivolous because I can legitimately argue that the time that Mr. Pappas's son consumed should not have been counted against his client. So it's not frivolous. The client wants that position to be taken. It not being frivolous, I have an obligation to make it as I read the case law and the rules, in the same way that I've made other arguments as appointed counsel before this court that were not frivolous and therefore.
I'm not accusing you of any improper conduct. I was just thinking that it seemed a little bit ironic.
It is ironic, but because Mr. Jones still believes that the advice that he received from this attorney, his non-attorney, was the right advice, that he wants to push this. Hopefully, I will not have an obligation to make a U.S. Supreme Court petition based upon Speedy Trial Act, but I understand my obligations may include doing so. That's just part of what we sign up for. I will make any non-frivolous argument that my client insists be made, regardless of my advice that it not be made. And this is true, but it also, I think, clarifies what kind of harm can be done by people like Mr. Pappas here, or by this National Legal Professional Associates case in the Seventh Circuit, that people will listen to sources that have no real power to have no obligation to do what's in their best interest. And it's one thing when it's a family member or a friend, but it's a whole other thing when it's an attorney. It adds a belief, or a former attorney, it adds a belief that the person knows what they're talking about. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you both for your argument, and the case will be submitted.